Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Many people can remember the date Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, but what set the stage for the successful lunar landing was a lesser-known yet remarkable achievement, the Apollo 8 mission, which launched 50 years ago on December 21st. Martin Sandler has written more than 70 books for children and adults. One of his most recent books is Apollo 8, The Mission That Changed Everything. Marty, welcome back. Always good to see you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
All right, so May 1961, President John F. Kennedy made a bold and surprising statement. He said, I believe that this
nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish.
Why did Kennedy set his sights on the moon?
Well, first of all, it's one of the great chutzpah statements of all time. I mean, we didn't even have rockets that could go anywhere near there. But the answer to your question, the right question, and the answer is very simple. He just wanted to beat the Russians. I mean, the space race is an absolute product of the Cold War, and it's an important outbreak of the Cold War, or a part of the Cold War. And, you know, I know when I was doing the research for this book, which was great fun, when I was doing the research for this book, I think the best thing I found was that when this whole program started and after Kennedy made that announcement, that extraordinary announcement, he kept going to Alan Webb, who was in that time the first head of NASA, and he kept saying, "You keep pushing about science, because we got to raise money." And Webb was the one who really was pushing things. That's how we'll raise money for this project. We'll tell everybody the incredible scientific benefits of all this. And then I saw this memo from him about 8 months later saying, "Alan, please stop asking me to talk about science. You got to understand, I don't give a damn about science. I just want to beat the Russians." And that's what it was about. I mean, you had to be there. But it was one of the most intense races in history.
Yeah. Now, there were a number of Russian triumphs in space. What were they, and why was space exploration so important to both countries at that time?
I don't think. Well, first of all, both countries are trying to win the minds and the hearts and the loyalty of uncommitted nations around the world, and so it's communism against democracy, but I don't think anything in history ever shook up the people of this nation and its leaders more than when that thing called Sputnik suddenly appeared in the sky. And suddenly we realized that at any time, the Russians can drop any kind of armaments they want off that thing onto any one of our cities. So there's that. But there's also the incredible loss of prestige. We had been told, since time immemorial, we are the greatest nation in the world. Russians are second, maybe third. And suddenly, there they are, looking down on us from space. So that's the thing. And then, as if that's not bad enough, they send a space capsule up with a dog in it, something living. And then, to really rub it in, they send Yuri Gagarin up. And so they've got a man orbiting the Earth, and we haven't done anything really.
Yeah. So while the U.S. was pretty open about their space program, the Russians were more secretive. Little was known about Sergei Korolev, who was behind the success of the various Sputniks. He had a remarkable personal story. He served 6 years in Joseph Stalin's labor camps before he was recognized for his skill and knowledge in rocketry. So tell us a little bit more about him.
He is one of the great, great unknown stories in history. I mean, the man was a genius. He was the first great, you know, he's the predecessor to Wernher von Braun. He's one of the great rocket scientists. He's Russian. Interestingly enough, again, you had to be there. It's hard to believe. But the reason that the Russians kept his presence secret, they were scared to death if the Americans found out about him, they'd kill him, that they would assassinate him. Because he is the one single person responsible for Sputnik. He's responsible for Gagarin's flight. He is the father and the whole progenitor of the Russian space program. And he put the Russians way ahead of us. But on the other hand, it's Stalin's Russia. And before he did all that, he did something. No one's quite sure, but with all the purges, Stalin threw him into one of the gulags, and he would have rotted there, except somebody let Stalin know, hey, you've taken one of our great rocket scientists and put him.
He's got him in the wrong place.
They had him in the wrong place. But man, he came out, and he had an incredible career. It wasn't until the day he died, never mind the Americans, that the Russian people found out there was a guy named Karlov and that he was responsible for all this.
Another Russian who contributed greatly to the development of rocket science, I'm going to probably butcher his name, is it Tsiolkovsky?
Yeah.
Oh, I said it right? You write that as early as 1903, he declared rockets would be the best means of traveling into space, and that laid out many of the principles of modern rocketry. He was inspired by science fiction, the writings of Jules Verne and H.G. Wells. Interesting to think how blurred the lines between science fiction and reality become after the passage of time. So tell us a little bit more about
that. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I can't emphasize enough how important Jules Verne is in all of this space program. I mean, whether it was Robert Goddard, who was our first great rocket scientist, whether it was von Braun, who gets mixed reviews from me, but I'm sure we'll talk about that later. But yeah, when the early books that he wrote, I mean, he hit it right on the nose in many ways about space travel and about rocketry, and he convinced people through his books that it was possible and that someday men would land on the moon.
All right, so tell us more about Tsiolkovsky, if I said it right again.
Yeah, well, he's one of the early Russian geniuses. He's one of the ones who inspired Karlov. He's one of the ones who he founded this Institute of Rocketry long before the United States was doing any of this.
There, as you mentioned, we have the NASA's Goddard Space Center in Maryland, named after Robert Goddard, and you just mentioned him. But talk a little bit about Goddard, his early research and design of rockets.
Well, he's working out of Worcester, Massachusetts, or more accurately, Woburn, right outside of Worcester. He is sending up rockets that we would laugh at today. I mean, you know, they're the kind of rockets that kids send up today. But he's getting them up in the air. But most important of all, he really believes that with the right fuel and with the right research that someday man will be. Now, he cannot foresee. He cannot foresee when the, I may be jumping ahead, but you're used to that one from me. But he cannot foresee a Saturn rocket that's got 700 million gallons of gasoline in it. He cannot foresee rockets that can take men a half a million miles up and a half a million miles back. But he thinks that maybe, just maybe, and you know, everything has to have its beginnings and everything has to have its leaders and its visionaries. He is the greatest visionary, the American visionary for rocketry.
So JFK sets the wheels in motion for NASA to start a lunar program, and NASA develops Saturn V, which was like anything else the world had seen at that point. It was huge. Give us a sense of the size.
Well, it's very easy to give you a sense because I found the most dramatic example you could possibly think of. When they built the Saturn rocket, they couldn't build it vertically. They had to have it horizontally because there was nothing. It was just too tall. And then they had to put it into an enclosure while they were working on the side and so forth. So they built this extraordinarily tall building. That building was so tall that it had its own environment, that at the upper reaches it would snow simply because the air would change in density and so forth. That's how big it was. And then it took days to move that rocket from out of that building to the launch pad. I mean, it was like 0.01% of, you know, a mile per hour. But it's an extraordinary thing. I mean, talk about chutzpah. That rocket had never, ever carried a human being. It had only been tested twice before they're going to send these guys off. Both times it crashed. The three astronauts who are going to go up in this rocket, and let me just backtrack a little, Mindy, and just say that Apollo 8 was not supposed to go around the moon. Apollo 8 was supposed to be yet another launch that would test certain equipment, most particularly the lunar lander. But the lunar lander wasn't ready. So they were going to test other equipment, most of it retesting. What happens is that they get a note, and NASA gets an urgent message from the CIA saying that we have information that the Russians are going to put two men in and send them around the moon. First people ever to leave the bars of Earth. We're not going to have any of that.
Right.
So we take, we make Frank Borman the commander. We make Jim Lovell the navigator. We take Bill Anders, who has never been in space at all or anything connected with it, make him the third pilot. And we're going to put them on top of this. Yeah. Borman said he had about a 40% chance of coming out of it alive.
Yeah.
His wife said zero.
Yeah, we're jumping ahead. I want to go back.
Saturn
V was developed by Wernher von Braun, who was born in Poland in 1912. He was raised in Germany. When World War II began, von Braun was head of the German rocket program, and his rockets were used against the Allies. How involved was he in the Nazi Party, and how did he find his way to the American space program?
Well, I'm very hard on Wernher von Braun in the book because I did an awful lot of research into that, and he was a genius. We wouldn't have gotten to the moon without him. There was a lyricist, a songwriter, during those days called Tom Lehrer, that many in your audience will know, and he had these greatest lyrics of all that said, as long as they go up, who cares where they come down? That's not my department, said Wernher von Braun. Wernher von Braun just wanted to send rockets up, and he just wanted to get to the moon. But unfortunately, what my research has uncovered is that he actively recruited rocket people for the slave labor camps in Germany where they were being built. So it's a dual thing. One, yeah, he builds the rockets, the V-2s, that destroy London and kill so many civilians. Well, that's war, okay? But number two, he actively helps capture puts the finger on people that are going to be put into these slave camps to work on them. The other side of the coin is we never could have done any of it without him because he was a genius. And he's totally responsible for the Saturn rocket. And the Saturn rocket is totally responsible for first getting men around the moon with Apollo 8 and then having men land on Apollo 11.
All right. So you talked about this intelligence that we got, which changed the mission. The risks involved in the Apollo 8 mission were not insignificant. You write, the Saturn V was not only the largest and most powerful rocket ever built, it was also the most complex and most prone to disaster. Together, the Saturn V and the Apollo 8 spacecraft had 5.6 million parts. Even if 99.9% of those parts worked perfectly, that left 5,600 of them to cause a calamity.
That's right.
And as you mentioned, the two previous tests hadn't been without incident. So this is really...
It's a miracle.
It's a miracle.
And I'm probably jumping ahead on you again, but it's the other miracle, one of the other great miracles is that, you know, they've got this thing called an SPS engine in it, okay, in this thing. They're going to fire the SPS engine to get them into Earth orbit, okay? If it fires 5 seconds too early, 5 seconds too late, they're going to be in orbit for the rest of eternity. Mm. Then they're going to fire it to become the first ones ever to head toward moon orbit. If it fires 5 seconds too early or fires too late, same thing. Then they're going to fire it a third time to send it in the become the first ever in history to go in moon orbit around the moon. If it fires 5 seconds too early, 5 seconds too late, they're croaked.
Yeah.
And then it fires one final time. It's got to fire one final time with the same thing. And every one of these four times, Mindy, it fires exactly on the spot.
Yeah.
And it's amazing.
Yep. You write, NASA flight director Gene Kranz confided to his close friends that he believed the astronauts had a 50% chance of returning safely. Mm-hmm. Aside from the failure of the Saturn V rocket, what were the other risks associated with the launch and mission?
Well, the big thing is it's going to blow up on the pad, you know. The other thing is it's going to blow up the minute it gets up. I mean, you know, we have, unfortunately, sadly, we have the evidence, you know, with the Challenger. There were two great, I'm amazed with all the research I've done on this and all that we know about this, I'm amazed that there were only just two great disasters.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe there weren't more. The first one was with Apollo 1, where these three wonderful, brave astronauts burned to death inside the capsule and they couldn't get him out. When you read about how that happened, I mean, they had all these open wires hanging around their feet. They had water inside the thing, and you know, and they had a hatch that turned inward instead of outward. So they had no chance of getting out when it happened. And then, of course, you've got the Christa McAuliffe.
Yeah.
Terrible disaster. So that, I remember when, with the Challenger thing, you're wondering, what in the heck caused all that? One little panel on the side because it was too cold, you know? I mean, there's just so many.
Yeah. Like you said, it's a miracle. Yeah, it's a miracle.
Well, but as usual, Todd, you picked exactly the right quote, and that is that I had forgotten about, and that one about how many parts there were to this thing.
That's
and
amazing. Just one of them,
Any one of 500 parts goes wrong, they're dead, you know?
So
it is amazing.
Now, the astronauts, of course, knew the danger. This must have also taken a toll on the families of the Apollo 8 crew. So what do we know about how their wives and children felt about this mission?
Well, you know, I did a lot of thinking about that, and you have to understand that every one of these guys were test pilots. These are crazy people. I mean, you know, as I have told you before, I am a practicing coward, so there are times when it just blows my mind. I mean, these guys, long before they're doing this, this is why they were picked. They had risked their lives every day. Most of them were combat pilots.
You have to be calm under pressure, right?
Yeah. Oh, my God, exactly. Calm under pressure, fear nothing. I mean, so the combination of their lives as test pilots, going Mark 1, Mark 2, Mark 3, in planes that had never done it, and then in combat, you know, in the dogfights in the sky, they're also a little wild. I mean, one could write the most scandalous book about their private lives on Earth once they had been named. Because what's interesting to me in many of the books that I've written, I'm thinking about Elijah Kane, who was one of the great explorers and did so many things like, how did he possibly dare do that? Because he had tuberculosis and he was told he was only going to live like 6 more years. So many of these guys said, you know, I've got nothing to lose. These guys didn't have that, but they knew that they were hanging on a thread.
And they're making history.
And they're making history. That's the other thing. And they had a sense of that. The one Boy Scout in all of them, was John Glenn. Mm-hmm. And they really didn't like Glenn that very much because Glenn wasn't going out and getting drunk. And he wasn't going out chasing women all the time, Glenn. But these guys also, and I'm so glad you said that because that's right, along with all that, they had an enormous sense of patriotism, and they knew they were the first, and they wanted to be the first, and they all wanted to get to that moon.
Mm-hmm.
Although Jim Lovell said that when Apollo 8 was over, he said this is so much more important a mission than we'll ever have, and it didn't. He said later that he would have rather have been on this mission than on the one to the moon.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Martin Sandler. His new book is Apollo 8, The Mission That Changed Everything. We'll talk more after a quick break.
A lot of songs called shanties were actually used on working ships. They set a rhythm for working.
Local historian Mary Malloy.
And the songs made me intrigued in how ships worked. And eventually I went from the songs into the history. And after that, it was a lost cause.
Now you're ready to head for the horn. Away, hey, roll and go. Our boots and our clothes, boys, are all in the pond. And me rollick and randy dandy, oh. Heave, Apollo, heave away. Way, hey, roll and go. The anchor's on board and the cable's all stored. And me rollick and randy dandy, oh. Heave, Apollo, heave away. Way, hey, roll and go. The anchor's on board and the cable's all stored. To me rollick and randy dandy.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Martin Sandler. His new book is Apollo 8, The Mission That Changed Everything. So the launch of Saturn V is successful. Before long, the crew were at an altitude that took them farther from Earth than any other human being. You write that despite their tasks, they can't help but take in the view of Earth. Talk about the reaction to seeing the Earth from this vantage point that no one has ever seen before.
Excuse the cliche. It blows their mind. And number two, the best line of all is when Anders said, "We practiced for 3 years, and the word Earth never came up. We practiced 3 years to look at the moon, to analyze the moon, to go around the moon. We never heard the word Earth. And what became the most important thing in this mission is that we became the first to see the Earth from this space." And stop me if I'm jumping ahead, but what happens is that on the fourth orbit of the moon, they become the first ones ever, ever to leave the bounds of Earth. They become the first ones ever to go to the dark side of the moon. They're only 60 miles from that. They could put down. They could have put down. They just didn't have the landers. They did everything Apollo 11 did, and they made it all possible for Apollo 11. But on the fourth orbit around the Earth, around the moon, for just by accident, just by chance, Borman decides he's going to make a correction and turn the capsule around because it's been flying in the same position a long time. So he does. And like in a 1 in 4 zillion chance, he does it exactly as the Earth is coming up over the moon. And they get to see a sight that no one in the history of the world has ever seen. They get to see an Earthrise. And Borman quickly takes a black and white picture. Anders says, "We got to get this in color." And he scrambles through the capsule and finds the color film. And he takes a color picture. And that color picture has become probably the most famous picture ever taken in the history of photography. But more than that, and I know it's a wild statement, so I spent a lot of time corroborating this. That picture absolutely launches the world into the environmental program.
Yeah.
The greatest environmentalists the world has had have said that's the way, that was the beginning.
People
like Archibald MacLeish start writing things like, "We are all riders on the Earth together." Mm-hmm. We all realize what a fragile, fragile place this little Earth is.
Yeah.
And that, go ahead.
And I'm just thinking, we've seen pictures, obviously, in space now, and you can imagine what that is like to see in reality. And I've had the luck of interviewing some astronauts, not these ones, but that's one of the things they talk about is just the awe, how in awe they are when they look back and see Earth. And you can just imagine what that feeling must be like.
The astronauts that I've talked to, and I'm sure the same thing with you, the astronauts I've talked to, the more astronauts that I've read, they will change forever. Every single one of them. You cannot be out there and take a look and see that little place is our home, and
it's
part of this whole thing. So it really did. There were two things. I'm going to jump ahead again so you can kick me as you usually do, Mindy. But the thing is that there are two enormous things that come out of this flight that really have nothing to do with beating the Russians or getting to the moon or anything else. One is the Earthrise picture. And the other is that just because of the time, they're coming home on December 24th. They're coming home on Christmas Eve. And so it's important that the officials believe that they give a Christmas message.
Yeah. Oh, no, you don't go there yet.
I won't go there. Okay.
We got to backtrack again. So the Apollo 8 enters Earth's orbit, and it's during this time that the crew and ground crew are checking all the systems for the most critical step of the mission, leaving Earth's orbit and heading to the moon. And you write, "Lovell and the others had the gigantic challenges of putting Apollo 8 into orbit around the moon. By the time Apollo 8 got in the vicinity of the moon, it would have traveled 250,000 miles. If the path the spacecraft had taken had been off by even the slightest fraction, the spacecraft would crash against the lunar surface. Several of the world's leading mathematicians had studied the problem, but none could guarantee that the calculations were as accurate as needed to be." So this was a big gamble. We have to remember that this was 50 years ago, the technology available to work out these problems was, by today's standards, rudimentary at best, right?
Let me just give you the best example I know. If you go in right now to Kmart and you buy an $11 hand calculator, that's got more power than the computer that put them up 250,000 miles and back. So that, you know,
it's amazing.
No, it's not to be believed.
So one significant piece of cargo on board the Apollo 8 was a television camera. Before the mission, Commander Frank Borman was opposed to bringing it along. He was overruled, and it's during the journey from Earth's orbit to the moon that the crew transmits telecasts, including the first view of the Earth as a globe, which we've mentioned. What was the impact of these telecasts from Apollo 8 on the American public, other than the fact that it launches the environmental movement? What was the public's reaction?
I mean, we're seeing the first pictures from the moon, and we're seeing them live, and we're looking at people. I mean, now, you know, they say if they were going to send a guy up to the moon tomorrow, or certainly in space, I don't even know if it would make the news. We said, you know, one of the reasons the program ended, I mean, it also had to do with money, but one of the reasons the program ended, people got bored with it. Mm-hmm. It's hard to believe it became too commonplace. Oh yeah, they're sending somebody up again. Oh, yeah, we're going to see pictures of guys floating around weightless. Not then. It was a miracle. It was a absolutely miracle. And it was not just, by the way, it was not just that we were seeing these pictures of the craters and of the seas of the moon and so forth, but we're watching guys. There are still people who claim this was all done in the studio and it was a hoax.
Right.
You know?
Conspiracy theory.
Yeah, I can name a few of them, but I won't. But it was amazing to see this. And can I talk about the broadcast yet?
Sure.
They know that it's Christmas Eve and the American people expect something. But they don't know what to do. First of all, they're on this very, very shaky ground about doing something religious. And in fact, as I right in the book, there was this woman who sued them, the same woman who was responsible for getting prayer banned in the schools, who sued them. Now, she didn't win. There were like 200 zillion letters came against it. But the point is that saying that, you know, you can't do this religiously. So they had to find something, some Christmas message. The thing that blows my mind is that 2.5 billion people watched it. Now, they will never. I don't care if the Red Sox win 100 more World Series. Mm-hmm. We're never going to get an audience like that, okay?
Right.
The world was watching, and they came up with the brilliant idea. A friend of Borman's, actually, came up with the brilliant idea of read from Genesis. There are no more powerful words, and it's non-denominational. And so these billions of people all over the world stopped and watched men 500,000 miles away very passionately, very, very humanly, reading in the beginning. And
we are now approaching lunar sunrise, and for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face
of
the water.
And it stayed with people forever. So that you have, it's, you, I've used these words with you before, Mindy. You couldn't make it up.
Right.
You could not make up a flight that does this, and at the same time, you know, has this picture taken that changes the world, and then has this incredible broadcast.
Right.
In which the entire world gets caught up.
All right, I'm going to go back again now. So the next step of the mission, where we left off, is to get the crew into lunar orbit 64 miles above the surface of the moon. And Commander Borman later notes, quote, "It was a delicate maneuver putting a spacecraft into orbit around the moon. The problem is that if you don't put on the brakes at the right moment for the right length of time, you'll fly away from Earth for eternity." Talk about pressure, right?
Oh. Yeah.
And adding to the pressure is the crew has to do this on the dark side of the moon, as
That's
you mentioned.
Right.
So for people who don't know what the dark side of the moon is, explain what that is and why it complicates things.
Well, first of all, because no one had ever been there. No one even knew what it was. And you know, there were all these wild stories. I mean, we didn't know if you go around that part of the moon, do you just fly off and you never come back, even without missing the right engine blow off and blast off and so forth. And who knew what was on that other side? I mean, there were some very hopeful things. People thought, maybe we get to the other side. The moon's prettier.
Yeah,
maybe we're
going
to find people,
yeah.
You know, or maybe we're going to find green stuff. And what they found, of course, was just crater after crater after crater after crater. But they had no idea. And they also had no idea, are we going to be able to hold in orbit? Mm-hmm. You know, everything's new. Everything's right. The first time. And everything is scary. And, you know,
they're out of radio contact.
Good for you. I forgot about that. Yeah, they're totally out of radio
contact. That's scary.
That's very scary. There's no Houston guiding them. That's exactly right. They're a very special breed of men.
Yeah.
They
like
are
you said,
very
can't,
special.
You have to be good under pressure.
Honest to God.
So the crew initiates the burn to get into lunar orbit, and then there is a long wait while Mission Control counts down the minutes until the spacecraft will be back in radio contact. What was the mood at Mission Control?
Well, they're scared to death. Mm-hmm. It's also their incredible anticipation. What happens, by the way, as they're returning, is that Lovell pushes the wrong button on this computer.
Oh boy, does he.
He pushes the wrong button and the computer goes dead. So he's got no computer to guide him to the most difficult re-entry in the history of the space program, because they're coming from the longest distance, they're coming at the sharpest angle, and here's something else that's brand new. They're landing at night for the first time, and they're landing in the Pacific for the first time. So he starts to guide it by the stars. Now, thank God these guys are. They're so astronomically intelligent and so forth. And he does it. But, you know what I remember? Oh, God, I'm only 35 years old, but I remember this. I remember how we all sat as a nation when John Glenn came back. And there was that period of 12, 13, 14 minutes where they lost contact. And he came very close to dying. That heat shield almost burned up completely. And we knew what he was going through, but we couldn't hear anything. You just didn't know until finally. And at that point, and this happened this time too, this one, Houston, come in, you know, Houston calling, come in. And they keep saying, come in, and nothing. And you say, oh, God, they're dead. And then, boom.
So the Apollo 8 does reconnect with Mission Control.
Yep.
They've made it into lunar orbit. And this fact reverberates around the world. What was the reaction of the Russians and their cosmonauts?
It's very, very interesting that I don't know what the Russian leaders, that was never made public. But I will tell you, I see this in so many of the books I do. When you've got people from different nations, different cultures, and they're competing with each other, or sometimes they're even in warring with each other, but the people who are doing it have such respect for each other because they know what the others are going through. I read a long time ago, years ago, a carpenter in Russia has more in common with a carpenter in the United States or in Addis Ababa than he does with somebody in his own country who's a cooker, you know. Mm-hmm. And so there was enormous, enormous respect for each other. There was enormous joy that they had made it. Of course, they were terribly disappointed they weren't first. Mm-hmm. By that time, frankly, they knew they weren't going to be first. By that time, money is running out in Russia. The Russian government has changed, and they are not as committed as these other people have been. I think they were shocked by how quickly the Russian government was shocked by how quickly the United States moved forward and passed them, and then got so close to putting them in.
Everybody was
shocked.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, you write in the book that Jim Lovell remarked, "Well, did you guys ever think that one Christmas Eve you'd be orbiting the moon?" And even aware of the challenges that still lay ahead, particularly the dangers of blasting their way out of lunar orbit, Bill Anders had a simple response. Just hope we're not doing it on New Year's.
That's right. And I got to tell you, I have to say this, that God, do we need something like this today? Mm. I mean, do we need something? What we haven't talked about is that this year that they go up by the way, they're going in, you know, in late in December, almost Christmas time. It's 1968. In 1968, Martin Luther King gets assassinated. Shortly after that, Robert Kennedy gets assassinated. Then we have the Democratic National Convention, which turns into a bloodbath in the United States. Then in Prague, in Budapest, in Warsaw, the nations are totally, totally, totally rioting. The world is falling apart. Never did we need something good to happen. And that's what, so that is part of this whole story too.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but I'd like to see something that would give us a feeling like this
again.
That
same kind of feeling, I hope, yeah. We're talking with Martin Sandler. His new book is Apollo 8, The Mission That Changed Everything. We'll talk more after a quick break.
Oh, yeah, yeah, oh, holy. Come on. Holy, holy.
Francis Doohan walking his cats in Woods Hole.
Come on, Sadie. Yeah, when I want any of them to come, I call the Oli 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 call. And that's what they respond to. Oli Oli Oli! Come on, get that tail up. That a boy. He's like a little soldier. But he is a wild boy, too. I have to keep whistling because I have to keep their attention. Being cats are very curious. If I just walk away, they might not notice. You know, they'll be watching a bird or a mouse or something in the brush.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
Come on, Oli. What a responder.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Martin Sandler about his new book, Apollo 8, The Mission That Changed Everything. We talked about that Earthrise that they saw and that, you know, the video that they got and the photographs. And you include a quote from Walter Cronkite in response to that iconic Earthrise image. The major impression I think it made on most of us was the fact how ridiculous it is that we have this difficulty getting along on this little lifeboat of ours floating out there in space, and the necessity of our understanding each other and of the brotherhood of humankind on this floating island of ours. Mm. Even Walter Cronkite.
That's the most important thing about this whole thing. I'm very pleased with. You know me. I get a good review. I tattoo it on my arm. And I'm very pleased that all these early reviews that are coming in on this book are talking about this Earthrise and about how this is as important as the fact that we went around the moon and so forth. And this is a part. Yeah, it was Cronkite. It was everybody. Mm-hmm. It was everybody. I mean, that you how could you not? I mean, the quote from the small article that Archibald MacLeish wrote was magnificent about riders on the earth. We are all riders on the earth together, and it's a very fragile place. And mm-hmm. Why in the world would we be doing these terrible things to each other when we need? But that's what we are, unfortunately.
And destroying our planet. Right?
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. Now, the Apollo 8 crew knew in advance that they would have this Christmas Eve telecast. And as you were mentioned, they wanted to say something that would resonate universally among people of all countries, faiths, and backgrounds. Not an easy task. You mentioned that they decided to read from Genesis. And there's another quote from Walter Cronkite that you include in the book, which was his response to that Christmas Eve telecast. And he says, quote, "I'm afraid that my first reaction was, oh, this is a little too much. This is a little too dramatic. I might have even thought this is a little too corny. But by the time Borman had finished reading that excerpt from the Bible, I admit that I had tears in my eyes. It was really impressive and just the right thing to do at the moment."
And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
At Mission Control, there wasn't a dry eye. You know, and these are hardened guys. Mm-hmm. These are guys. Although I'll tell you what's wonderful about the whole Mission Control thing. You can do a book on Mission Control. And then I think I'll go home and do it.
It'll be done tomorrow.
Yeah. Exactly. You look at these guys, and these are the guys that put together this SPS kind of thing, right? First of all, let me tell you this. There were 400,000 people responsible for this flight. 400,000. But these guys in Mission Control, correcting the mistakes, correcting what happened when Lovell turned the damn thing off. Lovell is going to be the commander of Apollo 13, and they're going to save his life and to save the life of those. The average age of the guys sitting in Mission Control was 24.5 years. Mm. They're 24 years old.
Wow.
So it's amazing.
Amazing.
And it's heartening, and it's wonderful, and we need that.
Yeah. So on board the Apollo 8, the focus turned to getting themselves back home, and they were relying on a single engine to do it. The crew initiates the burn to return to Earth, and once again, they have to do it on the dark side of the moon, out of radio contact with mission control. And when the moment arrives that they should be back in radio contact, there's silence and more silence. Talk about a tense time.
Yeah, and actually, we had been used to it, those of us, the world that had followed, because on each of the, whether it was the Mercury or the Apollo or so forth, you know, you get to that point where you do lose contact and you come through and you don't know, and until you hear it, and then, you know, you asked about the families before. I mean, you know, just the family sitting there. And yeah, the wives, not so much the children, but the wives, you know, they had married.
They know, yeah.
They had lived with these guys. Although I will tell you, I think it was, I think it's Susan Borman who said, you know, it's terribly scary. And this is an interesting point. It's terribly scary. And people keep asking me, you know, how scared were you? But all the time, all this was going on, I kept saying, if he wasn't doing this, he'd be flying in Vietnam. Hmm. You know, right. I mean, the world's a tough place, particularly for people who are fighter pilots or astronauts, or these brave human beings. Hmm.
So Andrews describes the reentry to the Earth's atmosphere this way. Quote, we had to come 240,000 miles to hit something that was a reentry target about the size of a letter slot seen from 4 miles away, and we had to slide the letter into that slot.
That's right.
The crew and mission control knew that if they hit the atmosphere at the wrong angle, they could either burn up on reentry or bounce off the atmosphere and skip into an elliptical orbit around the Earth. The calculations had to be exact. And then, as you mentioned, something goes wrong. Jim Lovell accidentally hits that wrong set of buttons on the computer, erased all the navigational information, the information that they're going to need to get that entry angle just right. And so, but the crew, again, I think I would be freaking out. But they're like, okay, you know, we'll just look at the stars. We'll figure this. And again, it's like miracle upon miracle upon miracle.
Yeah, yeah.
That
exactly.
they do it.
Well, not only they do it. Now I'm going to jump ahead again. I'm sure I'm going to ruin it for you.
No,
again,
you're not.
The thing that's incredible is they're coming from 500,000 miles away, and they're getting closer and closer, and suddenly the people on the USS Yorktown, which is the recovery ship, right? They realize, we got to get the hell out of here. They're going to land on our deck.
That's right, yeah.
So they're coming from 500,000 miles away, and they're going to land on their deck? I mean, that's pretty good.
Yeah. when the touchdown does happen, how are the astronauts recovered? Talk about that.
Well, first of all, they're worrying about drowning because they immediately tip over in the capsule and a little bit of water starts to come in. But to me, because I hadn't been scared just thinking about it, but to me, this one of the scariest moments of all these flights, but particularly this one, they've never landed in a night. No, this is the first one to land at night. They're in this capsule and it's tipped over and it's full of all kinds of debris and stuff. And they've got to wait to see, God willing, someone's going to knock on that hatch eventually and say, okay, we're here to get you. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I did quote a couple of things about how they felt when they were lying there upside down and wondering, is somebody going to come up and open it and so forth. And when they finally open it, then they know they're all right. Mm-hmm. Then they know they're all right. But it's just remarkable to me that and to anybody who follows it, that they could do it. And to me, it's kind of sad that we don't have that kind of, I mean, I understand that we got to a point where I guess we were really the victims of our own success. Mm-hmm. People got bored by it. It's hard to believe, but they did. Secondly, we are spending billions. And I'll tell you, one of the guys who mostly, and I'm not saying this negatively, but one of the guys really most responsible for this thing changing was Teddy Kennedy. Teddy Kennedy started, who was a big supporter of his brother's program to put a man on the moon, but Teddy Kennedy became one of the leading persons out there in Congress saying, look, we got people starving here, we got people there, we got a healthcare program we need housing things and so forth. We can't keep spending billions of dollars to send these people up, you know? Mm-hmm. We can't. So he was one of the first, and it is a dilemma that now I've been following this whole incredible thing of landing that probe on Mars. I mean, are we going to send somebody to Mars if we really can do it? Boy, it's tempting. It ain't going to be me, I'll tell you that.
risks NASA and the flight crew took, they took enormous risk just to reach lunar orbit first. How do you think the focus and risk threshold at NASA has changed in the past 50 years?
Well, I think, you know, NASA has changed it. In itself, in that there just aren't the funds to keep this going. Now that I think now, ironically, what's happened is what Alan Webb wanted Kennedy to focus on, the whole scientific thing. And you know, I don't follow it as closely as I should, I suppose, but I just know that just what the Hubble telescope has been able to do, and what these various probes, you know, we know more about the universe than, of course, we've ever known. Again, it's money.
Yeah,
it's money. And if we would stop getting into wars,
you know
how long have we been in Afghanistan? How much has that cost? I mean, that it's difficult. I mean, I think any right-thinking person knows it's very exciting to open up the whole universe. But
again,
what else?
Big price tag. So what about the crew of the Apollo 8? What happens after this mission? They stay with the space program?
Yeah, well, Frank Borman does not stay with the space program. And eventually, Frank Borman becomes the president of Eastern Airlines. And that's at a time when Eastern Airlines is very, very... big airlines and a very prominent airlines. And
I suppose if you're going to want to fly, that's a guy you want to
fly
exactly.
with, right? If somebody told me, welcome to this flight. We got Frank Borman up front. Thank God. Jim Lovell. I'm fascinated with Jim Lovell. Jim Lovell flies this and is one of the great heroes of it, of course, as the navigator. But then Jim Lovell becomes the commander. Well, first of all, when that flight took off, Jim Lovell had been in space more than anybody else. He was in Apollo 7. So he had been in space more than any other human being in the world, in the universe. And then he flies this one. Now he becomes the commander of Apollo 13, the one which, you know, that's the one they made the movie out of, you know? And
Houston, and we've got a problem.
Yeah. Well, Houston, we've got a problem. And a lot of it, their being saved had to do with... I have to tell you this, you can appreciate this knowing me. Every time I see an ad for the new Neil Armstrong movie, and they're telling, oh, look at that rocket, how are they going to... I yell at the screen. But Lovell... went on to be the commander of this, and interestingly enough, you know, he wound up in space more than any other human being, but he never got his real dream, and that is he never got to go to the moon. Mm-hmm. Anders works for the government in several capacities in big jobs, mm-hmm. and then he becomes a hero as a rookie. I like Anders. I like the guy who had the most distinguished career of them all, believe it or not, was the guy who had the biggest disappointment in his life, he thought, and that was Michael Collins, who was the guy who had to stay in the capsule in Apollo 11 when the other guys got to step on the moon. But he becomes the head of the Air and Space Museum. That's one of the things I do in my books that people seem to like the best, and that is what happened to them.
Yeah, what happened after.
You go to the movies and it's all over, if it's a documentary and then they have on the screen, this guy.
Where they are now.
Where are they?
So did you have fun doing the research with this one?
You know me. I love doing the research, period. But this one, I'll tell you particularly why I like doing the research, because there's so much of it out there.
The book is Apollo 8, The Mission That Changed Everything. We'll have a link with more information about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Marty Sandler, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Burdery and William Coulter.